From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of Interfaith Alliance, and we're broadcasting from Air America headquarters in New York City. On today's show, a new documentary asks the question, what do the world's billion Muslims really think? And the film's producer finds hope in the answer.
You know, Muslims are not that different. There isn't a clash of civilization. There isn't a conflict in the DNA between the West and the Islamic world. We really do have reasons to hope for peaceful resolutions to the conflict that we've been engaged in the last 10 years. It helps me sleep better at night, frankly.
The executive producer of the new documentary, Inside Islam, tells us more about a landmark public opinion poll of the Muslim world. And prepare for your own opinions about religion to be challenged, possibly changed, when I speak with the author of the new book that argues humans are hardwired for faith. We'll talk religion and evolution when the author of The Faith Instinct joins me shortly. But first, we turn our attention to a subject of perennial interest to me, religion and the Supreme Court. When Justice Sonia Sotomayor was confirmed earlier this year, she became the sixth Catholic justice on the current court. While pundits and Congress debated whether her race and gender might influence her decisions, they gave very little attention to her religion or to the fact that with her appointment, a disproportionately high number of Catholics would occupy the bench. Now, let me just point out, there are two Jewish justices and there's one Protestant justice, Justice John Paul Stevens, who in all likelihood will be the next to retire. Rarely, though, do you hear this issue discussed. Let me just say, I have grave ambivalent concerns about such a discussion myself. Historically, I have advocated no religious tests for public officials, confident that was the intent of framers of the Constitution. But should we now risk such a discussion? Should people who are elevating the religion factor benefit from the silence of those who think religion should not be a factor? Well, I've been helped in my thinking about those questions by Daya Lithwick, who recently wrote about this matter and in a recent forum on religion and the judiciary attended by both of us, spoke about this matter. Daya Lithwick is senior editor and legal correspondent for the online magazine Slate, where her article on this subject just appeared. Daya, thanks so much for joining us on State of Belief.
Well, thank you for having me.
In the article you just wrote, you say that once upon a time there was an outright religious litmus test for Supreme Court appointees. Today, religion's almost irrelevant in appointing new justices. Isn't that a good thing?
Well, I think at one level it is a good thing. I think that, you know, there was a time that you could not get a Catholic onto the Supreme Court in this country. That's how biased We were. There was a time where you couldn't get a Jew onto the Supreme Court, and obviously diversity is better than that, and there's certainly a possibility that that speaks to a spirit of tolerance and pluralism where it comes to religion. But I'm not convinced we are tolerant and pluralistic where it comes to religion in this country. So I think that the act of not speaking about the fact that there are currently six Catholics on the court is its own form of problem. I think it masks the fact that we do have very, very, very real and grave religious differences.
During the Sotomayor confirmation hearings, the press talked an awful lot about race and gender and ethnicity, and they pretty much neglected religion. Why is religion different? I can't believe it's all because of the Constitution.
I don't think it's because of the Constitution, because as you said, we used to talk very explicitly about religion in the court. I think it's almost a matter of fashion. I think it's become very unfashionable to talk about religion. It's very awkward. It's considered very intimate. Whereas talking about, you know, and think of the Sotomayor conversation, we were so proud to talk about her Hispanic heritage, to talk about the ways in which her gender would inform her judging. I mean, it wasn't just that she was a woman, it was that she was going to bring this rich experience to the court. So it's so paradoxical that then when you come to talking about religion, there's this sense that, oh my God, we don't want to even intimate that she would bring some piece of that to her judging. It looks as though it's on a collision course with her jurisprudence. And so I think there's this funny anxiety about it. And certainly anybody who writes about the religion of the justices gets absolutely walloped. So I think that we've got this self-perpetuating cycle wherein right now it's just very fashionable to talk about diversity in terms of race and gender and even sexual orientation, disability. It's extremely unfashionable to talk about diversity or pluralism in terms of religion.
You point out that Justice Scalia says the fact that so little was said about religion is evidence that religion doesn't divide us anymore. What do you make of that argument?
I think that it's a very compelling argument to say, you know, we used to be riven by religious differences, and the fact that we don't talk about it means that it doesn't matter, that America's just past religious division. But I also point out in the same article that recently Sandra Day O'Connor, of all people, was asked about diversity on the court, and she just sort of blurted out without being asked about religious diversity. She was asked about geographic diversity. She simply blurted out, quote, "I don't think all the justices should be of one faith, and I don't think they should all be from one state." Mm-hmm. So clearly his colleague O'Connor is bothered by the fact that all the justices seem to be increasingly of one faith. So I don't think that Scalia is quite right that we're past it. I think that the problem we have is when we start to think about the possibility that a justice's religious views, as opposed to gender or race, inform their jurisprudence, it starts to get very, very hard to connect the dots. And I think that smokes out all sorts of anxiety about judicial philosophy, about originalism, all sorts of anxiety that's much more profound than the simple anxiety about how say race or gender divides us.
Dahlia, why is it that we give so much attention to the religion of our elected officials? It's even prominent in the stump speeches in their campaigns. And yet we don't carry that over to our discussions of justices. How do they escape that fate?
Well, I think the nut of it is that anxiety you articulated at the very beginning. We're terrified of having a religious litmus test for the court. It seems to be so blatantly in conflict with our constitutional values. But as I grappled with this question myself in writing this article, it really finally occurred to me that because we have this utterly secular system of government, we've come to elevate the court into almost a secular national church. Mm. And I think absolutely Americans think of the Constitution as a secular holy text. I mean, this is our founding, foundational, almost religious text. And I think that because the court has become, as compared to Congress or the White House, it's become the branch of government in which we have to have some enormous amount of faith that it is following this document, that it is applying neutrally the law. Mm-hmm. To inject a conversation about religion into something that is almost religious in and of itself feels like a violation. It feels like a kind of heresy. And I really do, as I struggle with this question myself, think that we've elevated the court to something akin to a church in this country, and then we have to really avoid talking about other religions and how that may influence our high church that is the court.
That's a terrific answer. It's a highly debated question, but does a Catholic majority on the Supreme Court make a difference in how cases are decided? And let me just give you a pragmatic, and you can respond to both or neither or either. I have to wonder if the political activism of the bishops is partly a motivating factor in more people being willing to talk about religion and the judiciary.
I think that's probably right. I think that this is a funny confluence of the bishops having an enormous influence, for instance, on the health reform debate, at the same moment that it appears that the court has done really a whiplash quick change on its abortion jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. And the difference in the change over a very, very compressed amount of time between a court that was willing to allow partial birth abortion in 2000 and then said it deemed it unconstitutional just a short few years later was the substitution of Samuel Alito for Sandra Day O'Connor. So certainly the argument has been made, I'm not sure how persuasively, that was the impact of having a fifth Catholic justice on the court. So I think that both, if people are more willing to say that in a way they weren't, that's interesting that abortion doctrine changed when the really fundamental change became one of the composition of the court. But I think also, as you point out, there seems to be a sense that we're talking more openly in this country about the role of religion in the law.
Dahiah Lithwick is senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate Magazine. A very informed and informing person. Dahiah, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Up next, New York Times science writer Nicholas Wade joins me to talk about what he discovered about the relationship between religion and human evolution. It's not the kind of discussion that you usually have about those two. Are humans genetically predisposed to faith? We'll find out more when we come back. Stay tuned. You'll like this segment. Welcome back to State of Belief, everybody. I'm Welton Getty. Nearly every society throughout history has practiced religion. And while rituals and beliefs may vary, the act of gathering in worship has been present in communities in every region of the world for the last 50,000 years. Now, how does one explain the universality of this practice of religion? According to a new book, the answer lies in human evolution. The book is called The Faith Instinct, How Religion Evolved and Why It Endures. The book is written by New York Times science reporter Nicholas Wade. Religion, as Wade writes, played such a positive role in early societies, binding people together, creating a moral fabric, that it became ingrained in human nature. Humans essentially became hardwired for faith. Joining me right now to talk more about this subject is Nicholas Wade. Nicholas, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thanks for inviting me.
Now, what evidence do you see for the existence of what you call the faith instinct?
Well, the best evidence is that, as you mentioned just now, religion is universal. So it's an ancient behavior, but it's found in every society throughout the world, which strongly suggests that it has a biological or a genetic basis.
I often quote my friend Karen Armstrong on this show when she says that all the world's religions boil down to the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. She sees that as evidence that compassion can be found at the heart of all religion. You seem to be saying, and I certainly don't want to put words in your mouth, that this golden rule actually had very practical implications in that it helped societies survive. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that is correct. But I have I put it slightly differently from the way Karen does. I think the moral instinct is separate from the religious instinct. I think we do have a moral instinct, and you can see the beginnings of it in monkey and ape societies. But there's a difference between knowing what is right and actually doing it. And I think the religious instinct came along later in our evolution and was a way of enforcing what is there in the moral instinct of placing in people's minds the idea of a divine overseer who would punish them severely if they didn't follow their inner moral leanings.
So in some ways, the religion instinct, the instinct of faith, is even stronger.
Yes, it's more encompassing than the moral instinct. It has a more general purpose, which is essentially to give group cohesion to a society, to get everyone on the same page, emotionally committed to doing whatever it is that the society needs to do to survive. So that includes the moral, sustaining the moral fabric internally, and externally it means being willing to defend the society against others.
Are you arguing at all that an early society of atheists would not have survived?
I think that is exactly the implication. That in these early societies, the pace of warfare was very intense, and the only ones that survived were those that had a strong religious instinct, and we are the descendants of those survivors. Now, the situation in modern societies is a little different. I think you need a society to have some religious instinct, some way of sustaining the moral fabric, but on an individual basis, it doesn't make a lot of difference if many members of that society are agnostics or atheists.
I talk with a lot of people today who say they have nothing to do with organized religion, but personal spirituality is extremely important to them. Where do they fit into this?
Well, I think they fit in because, as I argue, everyone has this sort of yearning for religion, this willingness to emotionally commit to the religion of their community built into their genes, into their neural circuits. So usually this happens around the age of puberty. That's when people are confirmed or bar mitzvahed. That's when people went through initiation rites in primitive societies. And that's when religion is meant to be learned. There's a sort of biological window for it, just as there's a biological window for learning language. Now, if you don't learn religion during that window, maybe, I think for many people, you're still left with that sort of residual yearning for spirituality, for the belief there must be something out there larger than ourselves. And that's why so many people without a formal religion, nonetheless, are still trying to find one.
My guest is Nicholas Wade. His new book is The Faith Instinct. We're going to continue this conversation more after this very short break. So don't go away. This is State of Belief, Air America Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief, everybody. I'm speaking today with New York Times science reporter Nicholas Wade. We're talking about his fascinating new book, The Faith Instinct, How Religion Evolved and Why It Endures. Nicholas, thanks for staying with us for another segment.
It's my pleasure.
You have a fascinating chapter in the book in which you write about religion and commerce. You say that as a society evolved from hunter-gatherer to settled societies, that religion was key to setting up early economies. Now, how is that so?
Well, religion was the method of government for primitive societies. It did absolutely everything that these early societies needed to do to get them organized. So one of the things they did was to sort of trade things between each other, and that was done on the basis of trust. And the way you set up trusts in primitive groups was to do it within the framework of religion. So many primitive peoples have exchanges like the potlatch ceremonies of the West Coast Indians, which are embedded in a religious framework. And modern societies have followed the sort of general tendency of creating secular institutions that take over the role of religion. But often when you scratch the surface just a little, you find religion is still there. And I think this is probably true of the transactions that take place in modern societies. I mean, it's true we have the courts and the police for sort of policing and monitoring things that go wrong, but you can't possibly do that with every transaction. So, you know, the guy you meet in a store, the stranger you meet in the street, your interactions with them are sort of governed by this basis of trust. And if you try and trace that further back, well, where does this basis for trust come, which is kind of extraordinary when you think that it sort of exists between complete strangers in a large city like New York. I think the answer is basically that it comes from ideas of morality that are enforced by ideas of religion.
How do you understand religion as the basis of an economy that gives us disasters like the recent subprime mortgage meltdown? That had little to do with trust and a whole lot to do with greed, I think.
Well, of course, that's right. I mean, religion doesn't control everything we do, but I guess it sort of restrains it. It restrains greed in most respects. It's not perfect. Natural selection doesn't insist on perfection. It just insists on something that's effective over the long haul.
Uh-huh.
So I guess I'm more interested in the fact that, you know, economists just totally ignore the social framework in which economic activity takes place. It takes place in a framework of trust, which is set up by things beyond economists' ken.
I need to ask you also to extend it just a little beyond economics now and talk for a second about what kind of insight did you gain into the relationship between religion and politics. That's of particular interest in a nation that claims to value the separation of church and state.
Well, there's a very deep a connection, but it's also a complex one. I think the most immediately obvious aspect of it is that religion is a very potent way of getting everyone to rally around a cause. So throughout history, religion has been used as a way of galvanizing people to take political action.
Mm-hmm.
So the Puritan founding of America, I guess, is one good example, or the founding of Israel is another. And religion can certainly inspire great political movements.
I'm curious, Nicholas, to make the distinction here because it's not only, I think, something that relates to religion and politics, but it, in some ways to the whole thesis of your book. How do you say what you do, which I'm not questioning, but how do you say what you do without turning religion into a means to an end when a lot of people think religion is somewhat an end in itself?
Well, that's a very good question. I do argue in the book that religion is a means to an end. It's a means to giving us group cohesion, which is very hard to obtain in other ways. And then I argue it's up to each society as to how it uses that group cohesion, whether for good or for bad ends. That I think is what natural selection has seen. So that I would say is the evolutionary perspective on religion. But I should hasten to add that cannot be the whole story. It's just part of the story.
Mm-hmm. I know you see the same polls that I see. Here in the United States, more and more people are gravitating away from organized religion. Church attendance is decreasing. All the major denominations are losing members. What does this tell you about religion and evolution, and particularly what does it mean for the future of religion?
Well, I think it's very hard to say. I mean, the first thing one might observe is that the United States is still a far more religious country than most states of Europe that have been rapidly secularizing in the last 50 years. There is a sort of downward blip in church attendance. Whether it means a great deal for the religiosity of the United States, I don't know. I do believe that since religion is sort of imprinted in our neural circuits, it's never going to go away. But I wouldn't be surprised if it sort of waxes and wanes according to a particular circumstances. I think certainly in the United States, one of the features of our religion, which is very interesting, is that we have lots of different sects, all of which compete with each other, but in a sort of perfectly peaceful way, which certainly contrasts with the situation in Europe, where there are often sort of wars with different sects on opposite sides. And now some people think that because we have these many different sects furiously competing for members with each other, that's what keeps religion alive in the United States. The competition creates, in economists' parlance, a demand for religion, and that's why there are more consumers of religion in the U.S., and that's what keeps religion so vital here compared with in England, for example, where if you get a sort of stipend from your bishop every week, the minister doesn't have to go out and hustle for customers. There's no competition. There's a monopoly, as it were. So religions in countries where there's only one religion don't have to try as hard as they do in this country.
Nicholas Wade has worked at the New York Times as an editorial writer, editor, and science reporter. His new book is called The Faith Instinct: How Religion Evolved and Why It Endures. Nicholas, it's a great conversation. Thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief. We've got to pause for a quick break, but when we come back, a new film asks, what do a billion Muslims really think? Based on a landmark public opinion poll taken of the Muslim world, this documentary has insight into how the followers of Islam feel about issues of gender, equality, democracy, and yes, even America. We've got more on that after this short break. Stay tuned to State of Belief, Air America Radio. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Getty. In 2001, the Gallup polling organization began the most extensive public opinion poll ever taken of the Muslim world. During the multi-year study, researchers conducted tens of thousands of interviews in more than 35 predominantly Muslim countries, all in an effort to understand how Muslims actually feel, how they feel about gender, about religion, about politics, about democracy and America. They ask questions like, is Islam to blame for terrorism? Why is there so much anti-Americanism in the Muslim world? Who are the extremists? Where are the moderates? What do Muslim women really want? The results of the study were gathered in a 2008 book entitled Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think, authored by Georgetown professor John Esposito and Dahlia Mogahed, executive director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies. And now this landmark poll is the subject of a new documentary. The documentary is called Inside Islam, What a Billion Muslims Really Think. I'm joined right now by Alex Cronemer, one of the executive producers and co-founder of the Unity Production Foundation. Alex, welcome to State of Belief.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
I can't get my head quite around this. How large of an undertaking was this Gallup survey?
Well, it was a multi-year process that really spanned the globe, involved, I believe, almost every Muslim-majority country, and included a few countries that have substantial Muslim minorities as well. So it was a pretty comprehensive study.
You write that it's a mistake to simply look at the Quran and say this is what Muslims think, that you should instead look at how Muslims themselves actually feel. But, you know, given the diversity of the Muslim world, does a coherent picture emerge from this survey so that we know what Muslims feel?
I think that a coherent picture does emerge, and I think it also is correct that the Muslim world is extremely diverse, and it is sometimes a mistake to paint any global faith with one brush, because there are a lot of cultural influences, just as there are of Christianity. But I think the point that I was trying to make in that comment that you referenced was simply that often when somebody who is violent in the Muslim world does something, we so often find people who are finding a verse in the Quran that somehow is meant to purport, well, the Quran says this, that's probably why this guy did it, so all Muslims must think that or believe that and want to act in such a way. And the what I was trying to say in that comment was, well, I mean, if you look at any of the religious texts, you can find many comments that are both bloody as well as uplifting. And if you really want to understand what Christians think or what Jews think or what Muslims think, you shouldn't look at the examples of one bad person and then try to find something in the holy book to support it. Rather, look at what the world or what that larger population says, and that's what this poll does. So it helps us understand the Quran in the light of how the vast majorities of Muslims are interpreting it, rather than the other way around.
Alex, can you point to one or two things that surprised you most from the results of this survey?
Yes. One of the most surprising things to me was to find out the among those people, and it was about 7% of the world Muslim community that was polled, had extremely negative views about America. So they rated as having the most negative views, particularly in regards to 9/11. So about 7% of the Muslim world said 9/11 was completely justified, as compared to 55%, for example, which said was completely unjustified. But among that 7%, I expected that they would tend to be very religious people. They would tend to be, you know, fanatics or fundamentalists. And what the poll found was that among those, the vast majority of them were not really motivated by religion at all, but really fit more the profile of a revolutionary, you know, somebody who's wanting to reform their society. And their interests were really not focused on America, but really were focused on their own societies, and they wanted to, you know, overthrow the leadership, overthrow it violently, overthrow it quickly, and saw the attacks of 9/11 as sort of a means to that end. You know, by attacking America, perhaps we would pull troops or our support away from one of these leaders that would make that leader easier to overthrow. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the picture that even I had, I mean, I just always imagined that the very most militant in the world community would also be the quote-unquote fundamentalists. Well, that's not the case. So that was completely surprising to me as I began to delve into the results of what the poll found.
Alex, what should people do with this? I mean, there are great insights here, there are new findings here, all of which have a direct application to our society. How should people use these results in policy and in society?
Well, I think that it's important in all cases for us to understand that there's always a deeper story. And whatever the issue may be, it's important as we become global, you know, increasingly global citizens, for us to try to understand the deeper story behind the headlines. Mm-hmm. And something like this allows us to do that. That's number one. Number two, and I always say this, and you know, we've been doing screenings all around the country of this film, and you know, you always look out at this audience after the film is played, and you know, there's a sense of, well, what can I do? And one of the things that, and there are many things to do, but one of the simplest things a person can do is engage in dialogue and in discussion with Muslims. And there's a program called 20,000 Dialogues that allows people to get films such as this one and for free, and to use it in discussions and dialogues and help to organize those things. So that's something that everybody could do. And again, the program is called 20,000 Dialogues. If you just Google it, it'll come up, and you can find out more information.
Alex, I want to point out, you do not work for Gallup, and that raises the question of where your interest in the project came from. You've addressed that a little bit. So let me ask you just for a brief answer on what did making the film do to you?
Well, you know, for me, our organization, Unity Productions Foundation, has for the last several years made a number of films related to Islam or Muslims. I mean, our mission is working for peace through the media, and so we're, you know, trying to present the stories behind the headlines, or the stories that aren't even the headlines that would otherwise not get told. But what all of these projects have really done for me, and this film in particular, is in essence, they're reassuring, because when you live by the headlines, it seems to be a very frightening world that we're in, and it seems to be a world that's violent, and for which the only solutions to the threats we feel are violent solutions in return. And I've always found that every time I learn a little bit more about the history of Muslims or Muslim individuals, or in this case, in some way, getting the voice of the world's Muslims all put together, I'm always reassured at learning that you know, Muslims are not that different. There isn't a clash of civilization. There isn't a conflict in the DNA between the West and the Islamic worlds, and that we really do have reasons to hope for peaceful resolutions to the conflicts that we've been engaged in the last 10 years, and it helps me sleep better at night, frankly.
Alex Cromer is the co-founder of the Unity Production Foundation and the executive producer of this new documentary, Inside Islam, What a Billion Muslims Really Think. Thanks so much for the work you're doing, Alex, and thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you very much.
Well, friends, that's our show for this week. But you can visit us anytime at stateofbelief.com. Go there, please. You can listen to archive shows, you can read our blog, and of course, you can tell us what you think. We always want to know that. Just click on the Contact Us page and share your thoughts. And don't forget, State of Belief is brought to you each week by Interfaith Alliance. You want to become more involved in the cause of religious liberty in this nation? Then become a member of the Interfaith Alliance. We need you. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Next week on State of Belief, we'll have an all-new set of conversations about religion, politics, culture, always some surprises. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.